GBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Stephanie Officer. A salmonella outbreak has sickened dozens. California-based August Egg Company recalling 1.7 million brown organic and brown cage-free eggs distributed across 9 different states. ABC's Rebecca Jarvis.
Prices have come down a lot. The cost right now of a dozen eggs is about $2.63. And the good news here is 1.7 million, almost 2 million eggs, is relatively small compared to the total eggs we produce. Shouldn't drive prices much higher unless it gets to be a bigger recall.
Massachusetts health officials confirming at least 10 cases of botulism connected to a single health spa. It is suspected that Rodrigo Beauty in Milton was administering Botox injections without a license. Dr. Todd Ellerin, an infectious disease physician in Boston.
I'm not sure that there's ever been more than 10 iatrogenic Botox botulism cases in an individual state in the United States. This is super rare for any state.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Packers release Jair. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports NFL. The Green Bay Packers have decided to part ways with Jair Alexander. ESPN reporting the 28-year-old defensive back was prepared to report to the team's minicamp tomorrow. Jair Alexander has missed over half the games the past two seasons due to injury. Baseball tonight. The Brewers opening a 3-game series at home against the Atlanta Braves. Veteran lefty Chris Sale on the mound for the Braves against Milwaukee's right-hander Aaron Savalier. The Brewers losing 1-0 yesterday to the Padres. Desperate to score a run. Pat Murphy admitted after the game he gambled, putting in a pinch runner in for Rhys Hoskins in the 7th, saying it was a mistake considering Hoskins could have had another at-bat in the 9th.
It's one of those decisions. 7th, 8th, or 9th, do you pinch run for your slowest guy? It backfired today. It wasn't the right call today, that's for sure.
NBA Finals, the Pacers losing to the Thunder 123-107. Game 3 in Indianapolis Wednesday night with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Feeling better is about feeling all kinds of things. You want to feel healthy, sure. But you also want to feel heard and understood, valued, even, well, loved. That's what we want, too. We're Amplify Health. And we think the best way to care for someone is to care about them. That's why all our treatments include a little empathy. Welcome to healthcare that's all about caring. Welcome to Amplify Health by Belen. A little empathy changes everything.
From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Hope you've enjoyed Billionaires of Our Lives, the soap opera of the big breakup of the bromance between Elon and the Donald. What we've seen is, I think, what many women over the years have, the wrath that many women have felt over the years as these two basically men children who are extraordinarily wealthy and powerful with lots of connections, yet very, very small, very small tolerances and huge egos. And, well, you know, it's been fun to watch. Honestly, while everything else is burning down, while the dumpster is burning, it has been entertaining to watch each of these two go at each other. Like children, but worse. Elon, you know, threw out the Epstein files and then said that he would apologize profusely if there were a full dump of the Epstein files. But of course, then he goes and later deletes it because he was just rage tweeting a little bit. And then Trump blames Musk's behavior on drugs. Back and forth. And look, we could spend a whole hour just on the petty petulance of both sides. But the thing that I find interesting is one of my favorite parts is Democrats trying to court Musk some, which would be dumb. But Trump saying, you know, if he goes over to the Democrats, there'll be consequences. and also that he has no, they have irreconcilable differences. Now, for me, I took the position, and I wrote this on Substack on Friday. If you want to check out our Substack page over at Political Voices, I write a piece over there every once in a while. But what I think is interesting is everyone's trying to, you know, triangulate, trying to find their side, you know, deciding, you know, who's going to win, who's going to help advance their position, maybe put a little coin in their pocket, a little prestige. It's interesting, all across the spectrum. And my position is, this is why we shouldn't have either of them. This is the reason that we should be going after all of those people with so much power. But from the Trump side, it got me thinking about some of the things that he did say about how he would go after Musk. By one of them was threatening to cut off his Musk's federal contracts. You know, basically coming out and saying that, look, you know, I view government as I will reward the loyal and I will punish the disloyal. And if you're in, look, this is how little dictators play. They keep you in line by ensuring that your little crumbs are contingent on you knowing exactly which behind you're kissing. So you better not cross them. And look, that's not just politics. It's a lot of things. But I do find it interesting that no Democrats yet, and maybe they're there and I haven't seen it, but no Democrats yet are calling for investigations. Because look, you know, SpaceX, the little rocket company got contracts. Tesla's gotten contracts over the years. The Starlink, you know, a big winner if they destroy the broadband money from Biden. There's a lot of potential. You know, in past administrations, if this were a Democrat who said this, Republicans would be Benghazi-ing the you-know-what out of them. We'd have nothing but hearings on every word, scrutinizing every word. But yeah, Democrats, one, in their defense, they don't really have the gavel. They don't have the power to officially do it. But you know what? You can go into Republican districts and go, hey, as I've said for a very long time, adopt a Republican district. Hold informal hearings. Get out in the public. Raise some awareness to this stuff. Because this administration is the most corrupt in the history of this country. We are living history. We are living corruption front and center. And, well, you've got the Mike Johnsons of the world going, well, at least they're not doing it behind closed doors. They're doing it right out front where you can smell it. You can see it. You can taste it. And then I've got my conspiracy friends who go, oh, this is all just, it's a psyop. It's a psyop. You know, this is planned. It's a fake breakup. And I'm like, you know, I mean, maybe, Trump really is all about the ratings. So, you know, who knows? And understand, both of them have a long, long history of acrimonious breakups. Now, remember, I said this at the beginning, we would be here. Not surprising. No one should be shocked that we're here. I thought it would be sooner. I'm surprised it took this long. But here we are. Now, here's the weird part of this. As I said, in any other administration throughout the history of this country, or let's at least go my lifetime, Any administration in my lifetime, this would trigger investigations. There would be massive, even within the Republican Party, I think. But understand, the MAGA folk, they don't care about the show. In fact, they love the show. It is politotainment. It is, you know, this is what they wanted. This is what they voted for. So when I had a friend who go, can you believe this? I go, yeah, told you this was going to happen. And worse, it's going to get worse. This isn't the bottom. We haven't hit the trough yet. We're still descending. And the blue collar base of MAGA, they're loving it. They're eating it up. Understand that they've probably never been happier because Trump's going after the immigrants. He's going after the culture war. That's what's important. And that's what they've been sold on. Now, the fact that his golden age of the economy hasn't materialized, well, they poo-poo that up and go, well, it's coming. You know, they're still doing, everything's Biden's fault because Donald Trump said so. Everything bad is Biden's fault. Everything good is his fault. And they believe this. But here we are in a moment where Trump is right out in front of them, flaunting in front of my red hat friends that he's making the rich richer, making his donor class wealthier, enriching his family members. And oh, by the way, the loyal, not Elon now, but the loyal, well, they get the spoils. And this is where, you know, I've said before, we need to pick a side. And that side should be against both of them. I'm not on the side of Trump or Musk. I was expecting this. They should both be done away with. Now, I had said earlier that we need to eliminate billionaires. We need to eliminate the kind of wealth and power that a handful of people in this country seem to have been able to accumulate. And immediately I got pushback. You can't eliminate. And I'm going, no, I don't mean eliminate. I mean, make a system, create a system that is more equitable, that is more ethical, that is more moral. Because look, I'm committed to promoting a more egalitarian society, more equitable, more ethical solutions. I'm all right there. But we need to reduce extreme wealth inequality. We need to support social and economic justice. We need to do this. This, as working class liberals, should be where we are. And, you know, I've been told, well, you know, it's morally and legally unacceptable to eliminate billionaires. No, it's not. We've done it. We have gotten rid of them before. And look, in addressing the vast disparities in wealth, we need to have a comprehensive policy plan. This is where Democrats are going to have to get your egg on. Got to get that egg hat back on and start figuring this stuff out. And then you've got to sell it. We need policies that are going to make sure that the wealthy contribute their share and the resources are directed to building that fairer society like they did during the FDR years. The goal here is always going to be reduce the enormous, extreme wealth concentration, fund public services, and empower a working class to build prosperous communities. We need some policy. We need some policy chops. And they're simple. We need a progressive tax system based on income and wealth. We need not just an income tax, but a wealth tax. We need to start taxing Wall Street, bring in a Tobin tax or a transaction tax back. We need to close the Wall Street loopholes. All those tax loopholes that are exploited by the ultra wealthy, got to get rid of them. Income is income. I don't care where you derive it from. And then we need to take that money and we need to invest in public services and a social safety net that ensures when people have problems, when bad things happen, you don't go broke. We need to promote the idea of economic democracy as well as democracy. And for me, that means unions. Strengthening workers' rights, their ability to join and form unions, to collectively bargain, to do those things. And then we need much more transparency and accountability and knowing where this wealth is going. Because after all, it's our labor that creates all of it. On the progressive tax side of things, I would suggest introducing a significant annual tax on net worth. Anything exceeding $50 million, a progressively higher tax, much like they did back during the Eisenhower years, for instance. The top marginal tax rate back in 1953 was 92%. If you made in today's dollars around $2 million, that dollar over $2 million was taxed at 92%. You didn't get to be a billionaire because we either as a country took that money and redistributed it, you know, building hospitals and roads and bridges and funding our wars and doing all that stuff, or you said, no, I don't want to give it to the government. And you funded libraries and hospitals and paid higher wages and better benefits and put your name on stuff, invested in your business, invested in your community. You didn't have stock buybacks. I know during the Biden years, they put a, what, 1-2% tax on the stock buybacks. They were illegal, didn't have them because it was market manipulation. That's what we need to be doing. This tax would be designed to target accumulated assets. Massive property tax, property investments, massive stock holdings, all of that stuff. You know, all of these big companies that hold all of these doorknobs, they're not even rentals anymore. They're doorknobs. You want to know why the reason the rent's gone so high? Because big corporations and hedge funds and vulture capitalists have bought up rental properties. You know how you fix that? You tax them out of existence. Take that revenue, invest in healthcare, in education, in affordable housing. Lots of things we could do. On the loophole side, all of these taxes that are out there, we need to strengthen international cooperation to crack down on offshore tax havens. Going to do that forthright and aggressively go after tax avoidance strategies. Break those down. But you can't do that when you fire all the IRS agents because you've convinced the working class that, you know, Biden was going to hire 81,000, you know, guys with guns. They're going to go after your taxes. Yeah. You know who they're going after? The rich. The ones who hire armies of attorneys to avoid paying taxes and then go on social media and brag that they don't pay taxes. They live off debt. And then we got to go back to a higher estate tax and a higher inheritance tax. I know we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to go, what? Oh, death tax? At a certain level? Yeah, sorry. The estate's over $10 million should pay a little bit of tax. And the higher you go, the higher that tax. See how you do this? You have policy that move in that direction. I'm not going to steal all your money, but we're going to make sure that we don't have the kind of outweighted power that someone like Elon Musk has. The ability to buy an election. Because look, Elon Musk is right. Trump doesn't win that election without the $280 million and a social media platform that was doing nothing but echoing Trump talking points and attacking Democrats. It's the reason he bought Twitter. So for me, there's so much that we need to be doing. We need to go after these sovereign wealth funds. We need to go after these vulture capitalist funds. We need to go after those pools of money directly. And then we need to take that money and we need to invest. We need to invest in infrastructure, renewable energy, job creation. You got Mike Johnson and the Republicans running around, oh, we want a work requirement. Yeah, but there are no jobs for those people. Look, I grew up in an area, not on the bus line, no jobs in there. I know you could walk 5 miles to work every day. Let me know how that works out for you. But again, you know, we have so much that we could and should be doing, and we're not, because we're watching the show, man. We're watching Elon and Donald's breakup. We're picking sides. Now, look, you know, my view is we need a systematic change in this country to put reward for work. You ask anybody now who goes to work, they are going to tell you that, sorry, that reward for work isn't there. That chance to get into the middle class is getting harder. In fact, you know, I just saw a number the other day that showed, the majority of people, you know, sorry, not in the middle class anymore. Most of us not there. Pew Research Center. Ask yourself this. Pew Research Center defined the middle class as by income. Middle class being earnings at least 2/3 of the U.S. median income to double the median income, or somewhere between $56,600 and $169,800. Somewhere in there, they define that as the middle class, which is, you know, they're saying about 51%. Now, the weird thing is it used to be back in 1971, 61% fit that criteria. And understand, everything is getting much, much more expensive. So the lower you are, the closer to that 2/3, the closer you're falling out of it. So even that, now that 51% they're claiming is middle class, even that I question. Because everything's more expensive and we're falling further and farther behind. Families are treading water. Wages are stagnating. Everything's costing more. Debt is dragging us down. You know, the rate of personal bankruptcies are rising. We need to be cutting down on credit card debt and consumer debt. But no, if you don't have the money, if you're fighting, struggling to stay into that middle class, what we need is we need a safety net. We need the ability to help people stay in that one little designation. I don't use middle class as a frame, just so you know. I use working class. But every time we turn around, we're getting nailed. Now, for me, to be in the middle class, you need to have a decent income. And I'm not going to argue over Pew's income numbers. I would have thought a little bit higher. But security. You know, the fact that, unfortunately, most working people don't have health security, don't have retirement security, don't have the ability to miss a paycheck. There's so much here that if you really wanted a middle-class definition, health security, retirement security, station security, to where if something bad happens, that you've got a cushion of 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks. You don't want a society of people clinging on to this idea that, oh, we're middle class because I made $56,600, but I'm one paycheck away from bankruptcy. I'm one illness away from homeless. And it's getting harder. So while we're watching the sideshow, we're watching the billionaires go after each other, we're watching billionaires literally eat each other, we're still struggling to make ends meet. And somehow the show, the circus, is what they're focused on. And these are the people who told us they were going to make our lives better. Got it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. Labor leader Helen Marot was born to a wealthy Quaker family in Philadelphia. Helen grew up around the written word, as her father was a bookbinder and seller. In her youth, she attended library school. Using her writing skills, she spoke out for women and children in the workplace. In 1902, she joined Florence Kelly and Josephine Clara Goldmark in investigating child labor in New York City. Upon completion, they issued a report on their findings. The report was instrumental in the state legislature passing a compulsory education act the next year. Helen went on to join the Women's Trade Union League, serving as their executive secretary for New York for 8 years. She founded the Bookkeepers, Stenographers, and Accountants Union. She helped to lead the shirtwaist strike in New York from 1909 to 1910. The next year, tragedy struck the industry when 146 women and young girls died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Helen helped to investigate the causes of the fire, helping to uncover the negligence of the employers that led to the disaster. Helen's lifelong relationship to the written word helped her to become a prolific writer about unions and working people. In 1914, she published a comprehensive book, American Labor Unions. In the preface, she explained the purpose of the study, writing, "Newspaper accounts, while stimulating public curiosity, do not give an idea of the movement as a whole." Her book, instead, undertakes to give the labor union's point of view. Helen Marot dedicated her life writing about and advocating for the workers' point of view. She was one of a generation of progressive women who made a lasting impact on the labor movement, child labor, and workplace safety. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So there's an immigration raid in Los Angeles. Federal agencies, including Homeland Security, their investigatory arm, the FBI, the DEA, they carried out what was called a coordinated immigration enforcement operation on June 6th in Los Angeles, executing what they said were four search warrants at three sites, including two downtown clothing stores and a Home Depot. Authorities evidently detained 44 people and made one arrest for obstruction. And that one arrest was David Harita, president of SEIU California, who was arrested for allegedly obstructing federal officers. He stood in front of their car, evidently. Prosecutors say he blocked a federal vehicle at the scene. His arrest, he was then injured, taken to the hospital. He's been, released from the hospital, back in the care of federal authorities. California Governor Gavin Newsom condemned Harita's arrest, calling him a respectable labor leader, and criticized what he described as the unjust treatment of those witnessing government action. SEIU stated Herrera was injured. The arrest, he's still in federal custody, as I said. What's interesting to me is this is what we're watching, a dress rehearsal for what Trump is going to do across the country. And for me, this is, as they've sent, what, I think 2,000 National Guard people into California, to Los Angeles from the California National Guard. This is really a dress rehearsal to see how we're going to react, in my view. Over the weekend, I had people asking me, it's outrageous that we're going to use federal troops. You go, no, we've done this before. This is not new. This is what we've done. Think about the Bonus Army. We talked about that last week. Think about Kent State. Now, of course, Kent State is one thing. Jackson State at the other time, well, that didn't get the attention of the American people. And I don't want anyone to be injured, harmed, killed, any of that. But as we watch what's going on, it's going to take a tragedy before America wakes up. Because understand, the Red Hats, they're tickled. Tickled pink. Because Trump's doing what he said he was going to do. I had a friend go, can you believe this? I go, yeah, I told you this is what they're going to do. They talked about deporting 10 million people. How do you think that was going to happen? Do you think they were going to do it Mother May I style? No, they're going to trample on the Constitution. They're going to throw every law out the window. And understand, this escalation, this is to cause more chaos. Because the more chaos that he can get, the closer he gets to being able to declare martial law. The more violence, the more protesting, the more stuff that goes on. And look, I think we should be shutting stuff down. Because I've said before, the solutions are going to come out of the suffering. The bad stuff that he's escalating toward, that's the only thing that's going to wake Americans up. We're not going to just decide one day we're going to act. No. It's going to have to be something ugly and terrible to where we think it's going to come for us. Right now, it's just the others. And I had a friend ask me, go, well, there are Latinos for Trump. What, aren't they concerned? No. Because they don't think it's them yet. There hasn't been enough stories of people getting snatched up and sent to El Salvador. There hasn't been enough pain and suffering yet. And that's what it's going to take. So as he's sending these troops, look, he's setting the table for the disaster that is to come. How do we react? Do we just sit back and go, I sent the National Guard. Well, or do we get out in cities across this country to protest it? Now, I know there are going to be protests all across the country in places, but how many people show up? And how many voices are talking to our representatives? How many people are writing letters to the editor? How many people are going on their social media and condemning this action? How many people are talking to their friends and neighbors and their relatives saying this is just the start? You know, they arrested a labor leader. And my response was, and then they came for the trade unionists. This is history repeating itself. And it's happening in a place where we told ourselves for years, can't happen here. None of that stuff could happen here. We're better than that. We're Americans. Can it happen here? Yeah, it's happening. And over the next several days, going to be interesting to see what plays out. But it's good to see labor at the front of this. Good on that guy. Good on Huerta. Good on him. And good on SEIU. Back after this.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. An isolated shower or two this evening, then a clearing sky tonight, and a low in the low 50s. For tomorrow, hazy sunshine from a little smoke, warmer, highs in the mid-70s. Chances for showers and thunderstorms return Wednesday into Thursday. Currently 57 degrees.
Matt Nair on air.
Rick Reed is here, an economics instructor.
Remember the film, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? A driver is riding parallel to him and honking their horn saying, you're going the wrong way. And Candy and Steve Martin go, ha, 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 how do they know where we're headed? Congress and the administration are saying, this is what we're going to do for our budget. But at the end of the day, the Congressional Budget Office basically said that bill is going to create another $3.8 trillion in debt over the next 10 years.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, ABC News has suspended one of their correspondents, Terry Moran. Evidently, Terry Moran said that wrote on social media that Trump was a world-class hater. And he also described Trump's deputy White House chief of staff, Stephen Miller, as someone, well, let me get the quote right, a man who is richly endowed with the capacity for hatred. And I got to be honest, I don't disagree. But I'll tell you what this is. This is Trump playing the refs. This, again, is Trump going after and suing and using the courts to silence a constitutionally protected industry. This is, you know, another win for Trump and democracy. Well, not so much. And here to share some thoughts on this and why, I've asked my good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts. Sarah is a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website, if you want to check out her work. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how are you?
So what do you make of this? What do you make of this Terry Moran thing? Am I in the ballpark? Is this Trump successfully playing the refs and putting his thumb on the scale? Or is this just ABC going, no, you've gone too far?
No, that's the thing, is that we had that huge settlement with ABC and George Stephanopoulos's comment about whatever. So I think... What has happened in wake of that, that is kind of bubbling under the surface, is ABC has told the co-hosts of The View that they have to tone it down. And then this thing happened, and it's like, you know, I get it. If you want to discipline a reporter for saying, you know, I support this candidate and gave them money or whatever. But I think it's different whenever somebody is just talking about Stephen Miller being evil, because I feel like that's really something that's bipartisan. Like, everybody can kind of come together around the fact that,
right, on one side, it's a reason to hate him. On one side, the other side, it's a reason to love him. I mean, the right loves him for his positions. The left hates him for those same positions. I think it's nonpartisan. His his view, the view of people thinking that he's just plain evil.
And I don't think that that's political in any way. It's just, that's a morality thing, you know? So I don't get it.
I
think
they don't want to get sued.
I don't think it's not just that they don't want to get sued. They're running scared. Like, this isn't even about like, what would you sue them for being mean to me? Like, that's not how that works.
You've talked to Michael Cohen. You know what Trump has sued over the years. He's always weaponized the court. He's always used frivolous lawsuits to go after and silence people.
But I don't know how you do that if you're attacking Stephen Miller. That means that Stephen Miller's got to sue you. And does he really have time, considering that his wife is now doing something with Elon Musk? And I mean, seems like he's probably a little busy.
Is that the reason for the black guy? So I've heard.
This is the thing. Like, I never really know what's happening in the whole zeitgeist of pop culture, whatever. All I know is that apparently Stephen Miller's wife is now working with or for Elon Musk.
Or under.
And I don't know whatever else might possibly be going on, but.
Got it. No, I got it. I'm not jumping in the middle of that. This isn't the National Enquirer. But, you know, the thing is if our media, which is constitutionally protected, and, you know, it's one of those things that the Constitution pretty clear about, that first thing there at the top, if they're going to be silenced and they're going to silence themselves and censor themselves, you know, what hope do the rest of us have? Is the Democratic Party our savior? Considering now you've got the DNC chair, Ken Martin, I guess, waxing that this might not be the job for him, given this vice chair, David Hogg?
Which is so ridiculous. But again, like, anytime I think somebody who's older and established in the Democratic Party is challenged by somebody who's younger and hasn't paid their dues, then it becomes this whole thing of, you know, oh, I can't take this anymore. Like, God forbid you have a big tent that brings everybody in with every different perspective. And whether you agree with David Hogg or not, the thing is he knows how to raise money. He knows how to talk on TV really well and spin some excellent sound bites. And, you know, and I think he knows how to attract younger people to the party. And that's, all of those things are things that Democrats in the last 6 months have really sucked at.
Oh, it's just 6 months? Does your calendar only go back that far? But right. You know, here's the thing. And who didn't see this coming when he was elected, when Hogg was elected vice chair? You knew that he was not going to be the, you know, go-along team player. You knew that that was not going to, he wasn't going to fall in line with the DNC. You know, this is, you know, like it or not, this is what democracy looks like. And it's going to be interesting to see how Martin handles this.
Yeah, it's a messy thing. And I think one of the things that we learned from the Hillary Clinton Bernie Sanders battle, right? Like, this is not something that's new. And if you can't deal with it, then you shouldn't be party chair.
Yeah. Because there's a lot that you can be going after the Republicans over instead of shooting and eating your own. There's a lot of maybe he's not getting the news. I don't know. Maybe he's, you know, still trying to find his way to the bathroom there at the DNC. But there's a lot of stuff going on. Maybe, you know, there's that big, beautiful nightmare they're working on. The story over the weekend of Garcia, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, evidently coming back. And we've got the attorney general who's hell-bent on prosecuting and then making a bunch of allegations that she's not prosecuting for. Interesting. Lots of stuff.
That was the weirdest press conference I've ever seen. And I'll give it to the Wall Street Journal. The reporter that was there, basically, so Pam Bondi, the attorney general, went through this whole rigmarole of, you know, he was involved in killing somebody's mother, and he solicited photos of a, you know, explicit photos of a minor, and he trafficked women and children and drugs and guns and like all of these things. But he's charged with transporting an illegal alien, which means he drove a cab for somebody, you know? I mean, like, their allegation is, oh, he was working for MS-13 and driving gang members all over the country. And so there were just all of these allegations. And we finally got to the end of the press conference, and Wall Street Journal reporter goes, okay, I just, point of order here. You've got all of these things that you're saying, but you're only charging him with transporting an undocumented immigrant. So why would that be? And she basically dodged the question and then said, but let me tell you about human trafficking, and then went off of it and then was just like, okay, thanks, that's it, and then walked out. So to me, and a lot of the legal nerds that I watch were kind of like, you know, 50-50, this guy walks. But a lot of this stuff, it seems like they're trying to destroy this man because he fought back, you know?
Well, and I mean, it wasn't even him fighting back. I mean, you know, the labor movement stepped forward, and, you know, the fact that he was part of a union, and the SMART union, to their credit, you know, put this out front and center, and a lot of union leaders, you know, made this an issue. Without, I got to think, without the unions really taking this issue on, I don't think you hear much about this. I think the fact that you had the SMART union bring this up, and the painters and a bunch of other unions coming out and saying, hey, wait a second, that's one of our apprentices. Look, if he did something wrong, prosecute him and give him the due process that every one of us deserve, that every person deserves. You know, because you're not hearing this story about the other people they've deported. It's this one guy that the unions have, hey, that's our guy. He's going through this apprenticeship program, you're claiming he's doing all of this other stuff? It's ridiculous.
And I think, too, that really flagged it for Chris Van Hollen, the senator of Maryland, who really stepped up. So to be fair, you have so many unions who are employing immigrants or you know, people who either are here on a green card but want to get their citizenship. So I think for those who are like, yeah, this is our member, we're stepping up and we're going to protect him, I think right on. But drawing attention to it beyond that, getting the senators involved, getting DC involved,
look what you got going on in California. I mean, the fact that you've got, Trump sending the National Guard, you had a union leader arrested for some ridiculous chumped up, oh, he was obstructing. You stand in the way. I'm sorry. That's what we do. That's how you slow things down. But here again, going to use this as an excuse for the chaos that they want, because ultimately it's the only thing that their base really understands, because the economy, you know, prices haven't come down, wages haven't really gone up, the economy's not on fire. In fact, we're talking about a really bad summer into fall. So the one thing you do to keep the base all lathered up in the panties is start going after those people, send in the National Guard, cause some chaos. This is all, to me, it's all the dress rehearsal for what's going to come. And for all those people who go, you know, is this what you voted for? The red hats? Absolutely. Absolutely they voted for this.
And I think, you know, at the same time, we're seeing grocery prices still being high. And then it turns out there's a salmonella outbreak in 9 states due to tainted eggs. So that means egg prices are going to go up again.
Yeah, so but you get a little tummy ache, you'll be fine.
It would be something that the FDA, or the CDC would come out and inform everybody about.
But a functional,
all those people got fired.
A functional FDA and a functional CDC.
So that was in a local newspaper, and I'm like, oh wow, when's the next time we're going to hear about this from RFK Jr.? So again, like you're spot on that it's a lot easier to throw a fit and do crappy things to California because Trump hates Gavin Newsom, rather than actually address the economic issues that people want to talk about. And if Democrats were really smart, that's what they wouldn't get off on that. Like they wouldn't, there's no way that you could spin them off of that and be like, well, let me tell you about why immigration is important because of the economy, you know, like everything goes back to the economy.
Yeah, but here's the thing, you know, thanks to Donald Trump, we're going to all be singing the AC/DC song. I've got big balls because evidently we're going to have a big ballroom for big balls. Because look, you got big balls working for the government who, oddly enough, is afraid that he's going to get doged out of a job, which is weird. But here we are. This is the world that we're in. And sadly, again, this is the distraction. This is the bread and circus. This is the shiny thing, the cat laser that we're following well, oh so well.
Squirrel. Yeah. The Elon Musk dude who refers to himself as Big Balls, first of all, there's this huge feud that's going on, right, between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And so there are like 100 people that Elon Musk got hired in the government who are still there.
Yeah, his ferrets.
Who are basically, who are his people. And so I'm kind of shocked that those people aren't gone already. But then at the same time, like, now you have all these folks who, we've made such huge cuts. So what's the reason for Doge boys to still be there if they're not doing anything? And again, like, we're watching Trump spend all of this money. It's like $82 million is what he's going to pay for his little birthday parade. And then he wants to build this huge ballroom at the White House because he's like, you guys have these events and you just have big tents out there. And it's like, okay, I get it. The White House is not a place that should be, you know, nothing but partying all the time.
Oh, no. This is going to be just like Mag-a-Lago. We're going to rent out parts. Mm-hmm. When we're not using the ballroom, we're going to rent it out for weddings.
And it's crazy because it's like, I think it is his whole, like, I want to Mar-a-Lago-ize the White House, because you've seen what he's done to the Oval Office with his gold-plated yada yada. So my favorite photo, I can't remember who it was. I think it was a Daily Mail reporter on Friday. So after the story broke about, you know, this big ballroom thing that Trump wants to do, Daily Mail guy took a picture of a patch of grass that was probably like the size of a Barbie dream house, and said that, and it had like cones around this like tiny patch of grass. And he goes, I just saw Trump and the vice president walking around out here looking at this patch of grass. Is this going to be the ballroom? Like this little one by one space? So I don't know. Trump also said he was going to pay for it, which.
Yeah, hold your breath on that one.
Right? Like, that's the thing is, when was the last time Trump paid for anything?
There's a better chance that Mexico will pay for the wall.
There's a better chance Mexico will pay for the ballroom.
No, there's a chance that they might. The wall, never. But, you know, maybe as a gift to the ballroom, maybe. If they could, you know, slap their name on it, maybe naming rights. You know, the White House ballroom brought to you by the country of Mexico. I could see maybe that, or, you know, put right next to the big, beautiful plane that we're evidently spending several hundred million dollars to, which I don't get. But, you know, hey, but here's the thing. As I said earlier, how is this helping working people? How is the feud? How is all of the stuff that they're doing, all of this chaos actually helping working people? How's it making my life or the red hat, my red hat friends' lives? How is it making us better in any way, shape, or form?
It's just all the reality show that Trump wants. You know, it's all a distraction because it turns out fixing the economy while trying to, you know, drop taxes for your billionaire buddies is actually not an economically sensible thing to do. And all of the things that I feel like Joe Biden did while he was in office to make things, you know, like renegotiate the price of eggs and renegotiate, you know, all of these things with these major corporations that were basically jacking up prices because they were gouging because they were taking advantage of COVID. I feel like that is the conversation Trump could be having. But again, that would mean that he'd have to do something other than just, you know, watch Fox News and post things on the internet all day.
Yeah, but it's so much better because, you know, you don't actually have to have a plan or a policy. And as long as people are saying your name, which, again, I come back to, all this is his ego. And the weird thing about the two of them, both Musk and Trump, is they're both egomaniacs. They're both destroyers. And the sad reality is we're the ones who are going to end up suffering because of it, because the rest of the world's moving on without us. And for me, this could be a moment where Democrats, Ken Martin, hello, this could be a moment where you go, let's not try and pick a side. Let's say they're both bad and get rid of all of them. How about some policies that are going to move us in those directions, like I talked about earlier? That's what we should be doing.
Absolutely. And again, this is a great opportunity for the Democrats, but it wouldn't be the Democrats if, you know, they didn't let an opportunity saunter past them without taking advantage of it.
They are going to snatch victory out of the jaws, or defeat out of the jaws of victory. And maybe, you know, it's frustrating because there's a real opportunity here.
And Karine Jean-Pierre, the former White House press secretary, basically just left the Democratic Party. There are other people that are talking about, you know, leaving the Democratic Party to become independents.
Gosh, I'm so tired of hearing that. Those are the same people. I'm going to leave the country. Goodbye. I'm good. Go. You're not helping anyone with this. This whole, we're going to be independent, not helping.
And that's the thing, is it's like in a two-party system where we have states that don't even allow third parties on the ballot. That's not the same in all of them, but that is true in a lot of them. You really have to work within the structure that is there. And I don't know that trying to change the entire structure of the political system, you know, maybe that's a long-term goal, but it doesn't make sense short-term to be like, well, I'm going to leave the Democratic Party to be more independent and try and gin up more support for independence. It's like, no, I'm pretty sure everybody in the country is really all in for independence. So, you know, it's about creating kind of a political structure there as a party structure for an independent party.
Now, look, if I thought a third party were possible, if it were possible to govern with you know, a third of the vote, I would go, yeah, that's a great idea. It's not. You have to take one of the parties over and move them in the right direction. The Republicans have done that. They've taken that party where they want it. It is the party of destroying everything of the 20th century, enriching the very wealthy, and punishing others, whatever that other group is. And Democrats have got to figure out who they are and figure out how to have a message wide enough that people are going to go, yeah, these are things that we agree on. Maybe there's some stuff I don't agree with what the Democrats do, but for the most part, I think they're somewhere in the right area. And by staying involved with that, I think you have the opportunity to maybe hone that a little bit better.
It would be nice.
Wouldn't
it? Just the little things in life.
Just, you know, maybe having a spine. We'll start there. But Sarah, as always, I appreciate the time, the thoughts, great work there at Raw Story. Keep it up. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you. Have a good rest of the week, everyone.
You as well. Our good friend, Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out her work, Raw Story, rawstory.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day that marked the public downfall of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. Senator McCarthy had become the public face of anti-communist hysteria during the Cold War. He used his position as senator to make wild accusations against alleged communists in the U.S. government. He ruined careers and ramped up public fears of a menacing communist threat. Public officials, labor leaders, university presidents, and Hollywood stars and directors all became potential targets of the Red Scare. The hysteria took a particular toll on the labor movement. In 1946, Congress overrode President Harry Truman's veto and passed the Taft-Hartley Act. The act required that all union leaders sign an affidavit that they were not communists. Those with ties to the Communist Party, or those who simply refused to sign the loyalty pledge on principle, faced expulsion from the labor movement. The communist purges ripped the labor movement apart, expelling some of the most progressive and radical leaders. Senator McCarthy was the public face of the anti-red witch hunts. But some in the public began to question his bullying tactics. Then the senator made an unfounded claim that the army had been infiltrated by communists. For 2 months, the American public watched as Senator McCarthy conducted televised hearings into the United States Army. Joseph Welch served as the chief legal counsel for the Army. Senator McCarthy accused another lawyer of Welch's firm of having communist ties. Angered, Welch asked,
"Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?"
Many in the public watched the testimony and wondered the same thing. McCarthy's popularity and power was finally checked.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So again, when you've got a government like the Trump administration, like Trump's government, who is going all out to destroy any data collection, are you surprised when things don't get reported to you? Are you surprised when, you know, the salmonella is on the rise and nobody knows about it? Not really. Not really surprised. And that's the goal. The goal is to make government so dysfunctional that nobody believes anything that comes out of it. So that when they actually do something, nobody will believe that it was that bad. And now look, I've been saying for a while, these are destroyers. And this latest thing shouldn't shock anyone, shouldn't surprise anyone. But the Trump administration just canceled nearly $800 million in mRNA vaccine contracts for future pandemic flu preparations. And the weird thing to me is there are some people who are acting like, where did this come from? Oh, we're shocked. It came out of nowhere. But look, if you've been paying attention, this is who they are. If you were one of those people who were working in the fields or cleaning hospital floors or ringing up groceries during the last pandemic, you knew they were going to do this. And look, I mentioned this during the last campaign. We told you. And the fact of the matter is if there is another pandemic, the rich, again, will get their vaccines and everybody else won't. Just like it was back in 2021, the rich got theirs, ours didn't come till later. And now you've got bird flu spreading. It's spreading among cows and farm workers. And you've got experts warning that another pandemic just around the corner. And what the Trump government do? Well, they pulled the plug on one of our fastest and safest tools, which is this mRNA vaccine technology. I know the conspiracy kooks are out there, but why did they do this? Well, because of politics, conspiracy theories, or the same habit of ignoring science when it doesn't fit your campaign slogan. That's what this is. All this talk about ethical concerns or side effects, every major study that I can find shows that the mRNA vaccines are overwhelmingly safe. Meanwhile, the alternatives, the egg-based vaccines, they take, 10 months, a year to produce? And they don't even really target the right strain of bird flu, which is kind of the difference between life and death. The reality is when the next pandemic comes, it's going to be farm workers and frontline heroes who are going to get sick even before politicians start debating whether they want to act. We're going to have hospitals filled up again, and all, you know, the wealthy are going to get theirs. And look, what the Trump administration did isn't just short-sighted, it's dangerous. Gutting health programs, cutting research, dismantling the very agencies that are supposed to respond to emergencies while we're flying blind into the next pandemic, dumb. But it's who they are. And don't think other countries are going to send us stuff, because didn't you learn the last time how bad our supply chain is? We threw away our advantages. And look, this isn't red state, blue state. This is survival. But here we are. Again, an administration hell-bent on destruction. So remember, when the next one hits, I told you so. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. As always, wherever you find your podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Stephanie Officer. Terminally ill New Yorkers could have the legal ability to end their own lives with pharmaceutical drugs under a bill passed Monday in the state legislature. It would allow a person with an incurable illness to be prescribed life-ending drugs and with approval from two physicians. A spokesperson for New York Governor Kathy Hochul said she would review the legislation. In Harvey Weinstein's New York retrial, the judge received a letter from the jury foreperson today that said, quote, "I need to talk to you about a situation that isn't very good." Weinstein has pleaded not guilty to all charges.
After sending that note to the judge, he brought in the foreperson who told the judge that jurors were attacking one another and bringing up Harvey Weinstein's past. The judge brought all the jurors together, said they needed to be cordial and only discuss the evidence. They'll be back for a fourth day of deliberations in Harvey Weinstein's sex crimes retrial.
That's ABC's Aaron Katursky. This is ABC News. Warner Brothers.